Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by John Rurink and Jacob Kanzler. A little later, Alex Rosane from the Anderson Economic Group is going to be talking about Proposal 1. And then also later in the program, we're going to speak to one of the people who started the Draft Ben Carson for President campaign. His name is John Philip Sousa IV. He is the grandson of the famous American band leader. And he's going to tell us how he got this thing.
If you've ever played in a marching band, then you know that name.
See, I've never paid. I had no idea who that was.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't want to admit it to him. But
it's a huge, huge part of the marching band tradition.
Well, anyway, he has a very interesting story on how he got Ben Carson to run for president, and we'll hear that a little later. But first, the thing everybody's talking about right now is Proposal 1, John. Just doesn't really look good that this thing would pass, does it?
It doesn't look good. I talked to somebody who's pretty close to the campaign this morning, and I asked him, and he said there's an outside chance still, but if you were a betting person, you probably wouldn't put any money on it.
I've been saying that this thing is going to go down 60-40, Jacob, and the chances of it passing, I would put at about 10%. If you get that voter turnout down to about 1.2, maybe even as low as a million, maybe this thing passes just because supporters like school districts and local government types and road funding people and maybe some do-gooders go out and vote for this thing. If this thing gets anything more than 1.5 people showing up to the polls, I think it's a dead duck.
It's not looking good. The poll last week didn't look good. Yeah, I mean, the turnout thing will be interesting. I think it's supposed to rain tomorrow, so that could be a good thing,
that
actually.
Be a good thing for the governor.
Yeah.
If it rains. Thunderstorms.
Yeah, why isn't it not doing well, John?
It's the same thing we've been talking about for weeks. It's just it's overly complicated proposal. I think it's got too many moving parts. I think it's too easy for people to shoot at it. It's a lot easier in this kind of instance to convince somebody to just say no than it is to, all right, understand all these moving pieces about how we're going to change the way you tax gasoline at the pump, why you got to have the sales tax increase, and then why do schools have to get part of it, why does local governments have to get part of it, what does all that have to do with the roads?
Yeah.
And that's what people get down to.
The observation I want to make is I feel like everyone knows what's going on tomorrow. I think everyone's seen there's been plenty of coverage, there's been plenty of analysis out there. So I think everyone has kind of an opinion on it, even the regular average voter. But yeah, I mean, I think it's just, I think people are too skeptical of it. I think it is the complexity. I think it most people will default to no because of that.
Well, I mean, you would think that, but I think that part of the cynicism as far as trying to learn more about this proposal could be the reason why it ends up passing, in that the people who would just look at it, and you just look at it for 10, 15, even a minute, you would think, oh my God, what the heck is this? There's no way I would trust government with doing something like this. But then you just forget about it.
Well,
it doesn't.
It's
not something you think
last
about.
Last night I was talking to one of my neighbors who's a small business guy. And we've talked about this before. What came up? The lottery.
Oh, geez.
What happened to all that money that was supposed to go to schools from the lottery? I don't trust these guys.
You told them the lottery money does go to schools,
right? We looked into it. Yes, it goes. But there is a residing pool of distrust going back that far that a lot of people still hold.
Yeah, and Kyle, you've mentioned this before. The question I always get is, how do I know this money's going to go to roads? And it's not always an easy question to answer, but the regular average voter is just not convinced that this pool of money is going to be going to where it should.
Right. It's going to other things. So the other things would be schools and local governments. And then, the very poor get a tax break. And then, okay, there's nothing really else that the money goes to. You got the roads too. But anyway, we're joined by somebody who's taken a good look at this. Alex Rosane from the Anderson Economic Group.
That's right. And I think one thing you may have left out in the voters' considerations is that people are really cautious about changing the Constitution if they don't understand why. And you don't have to change the Constitution to come up with a bunch of money for roads, but you do have to change it to rededicate how you move around sales tax funds and so forth. And so this proposal changes the Constitution, and there's at least a sliver of voters who look at that and say, this changes the Constitution, and I don't understand why, and I default to no even more strongly because of that.
Now, you did an analysis for the Chamber of Commerce back in February, and now the Chamber has put this up on their website, and we're a day out now, so you can talk about this. You looked at what would have to be done from a policy standpoint if this were to pass, and then some options if it were to fail. Let's start with, what if this thing passed? There's a couple things the legislature needs to do, correct?
That's right. There are a few fixes in there, and some of which have, you know, we've argued about publicly with the administration a bit, and there's been some acknowledgement on them. One of them is right now you can deduct your what you pay for your vehicle registration tax from your federal income taxes, and it would change the form of the registration tax so that it's not what's called an ad valorem tax, which means a tax on the value. And so, you know, it's the IRS that ultimately rules on this. But I think if you read the letter of the law, it's clear we're getting away with being able to deduct it now. And it's nothing resembling an ad valorem tax under if Proposal 1 passes. So, you know, there are over 1 million Michigan households that would probably lose that ability. That's one thing that probably the legislature would want to go back and look at again.
And I think the House Minority Leader, Tim Grimmel, has a bill in the hopper to at least address that, doesn't he?
I know there have been various proposals, both in bill form and just privately, people saying, yeah, we're going to address that. But it's on the list of actions that the legislature would have to take afterward.
What else do they got on this?
Well, another one, it's more complicated, but the sales tax exemption for motor fuels that is written into Proposal 1 into the Constitution applies to motor fuel used for vehicles used on the roads, which sounds like a sensible thing because that's what we think of when we fill up. But that leaves out if you're buying fuel and it's not going to be used in a motor vehicle on the roads. If you use it in a boat, if you use it in a snowmobile, if you
use it, lawnmower.
If you use it in your lawnmower.
I just bought lawnmower gas yesterday.
That's right. Exactly. And so it's really not clear how this would be enforced. So either you'll need a legislative change to exempt all uses of gasoline and diesel, or you'll have to trust that the state government will enforce this in a way that people who sell fuels and people who buy them will be able to comply with and understand. You know, you could imagine a scenario where you have to maintain a separate pump if you want to fill up a container. You know, we just don't know what the rulings are going to be. Probably a legislative fix would be what would be in the offing for that.
It seems like the easiest thing to do would just be to replace that language and expand it to everything.
That's right. And you could do that in statute, but the constitutional protection exemption would be only on motor fuels for use on the roads. Yeah, and there are a lot of industries that were really paying close attention to this, like, you know, construction, for example. They have a lot of vehicles that drive around on a job site, and they use a lot of their fuel just driving, you know, hauling rocks from point A to point B within a construction site and so forth. Would they be able to get the sales tax exemption for that? So that's what we call the double whammy, where you get the higher motor fuel tax, but you don't get the tax break that the rest of people would get. It's an enforcement and compliance nightmare that would likely be fixed either just with a statutory change or with some sort of ruling from the and how it's going to be enforced, and I'm not sure what the plan is there.
All right, and then if this thing fails, you've got some proposals here that the legislature may want to pursue. Now, I was going through those before you showed up here. Kind of sounds like what's old is new again.
Sure. I mean, there's just only a few places you can get this kind of money. I mean, you can work around the edges with small, you know, fixes and more inefficiencies. But if you're talking about an amount of money with the word billion after it, you're going to have to rededicate, shall we say, a noticeable amount of funds or raise them. So you could get it from the general fund. The general fund is on the order of $10 billion. So you're talking about a huge change in rededication of funds. There, you know, some people are talking about doing that over time, so it's sort of gradually phased in, and we, you know, sort of freeze spending where it is now, and so forth. You know, that's an option that the legislator and the voters would have to consider, but it would involve a pretty big changing of priorities for how we spend our general fund money. And as insiders in Lansing know, a lot of that money is actually tied to federal funds, and so it's really hard to change it. For example, if people talk about, oh, what if we didn't have that extra cost from the Obama administration expanding Medicaid to the state, and you know the state pays for 10% of that going forward. So if every dollar you cut from that expansion of Medicaid loses you 9 federal dollars spent in the state. There's no constitutional or statutory reason why you can't do that, but that's a hard sell when you talk about losing federal funds. Things are less drastic with other uses of general funds. So that's one thing. Another thing is you can do what some House Republicans had proposed before, which is to simply exempt the motor fuels from the sales tax and don't raise the rate. And you just, in the end, it ends up being we spend more money on roads and we have less money in the school aid fund and local governments. and we kind of keep government the same size, and that's attractive to a lot of voters. That's an option, and that's something that, you know, tried to make it through the legislature and made it through only one of the two chambers. And then finally, this is probably where you're getting with what's old is new again, is, well, we have a couple of existing important sources for transportation funds, and they are the motor fuel taxes on gasoline and diesel and the vehicle registration taxes. Mm-hmm. And you can just raise them. You can raise them and reform them. And there are a couple of reforms that I think people would like to see. For example, the motor fuel taxes are on a cents per gallon basis that's not indexed to inflation or costs or anything like that. We raised them under the Engler administration. They've stayed at the same cents per gallon amount since then, 19 cents for gasoline, for example. Well, if that had just kept up with inflation, that would be probably close to 30 cents per gallon today, just that existing tax.
So our 19-cent gas tax should actually be 30 if we kept it up to the rate of inflation since 1997.
Well, should is a strong word, but if we intended to keep the purchasing power of the MDOT the same, yes, that's what we would have done. And that's why people include things like a wholesale tax. If you do some things as a percentage of the price rather than an excise tax that's a flat amount per gallon, one of the benefits of that is it automatically rises as the value of a dollar goes down over time.
It kind of seems like then it's what I guess the legislature can stomach then along those lines, whether it's some degree of cuts and then how many, and then any type of revenue increase, be it on the gasoline or on driver registration, how much can you tolerate? And then you don't have to do anything, I guess. Also, right? I mean, you don't have to get to 1.2. It's not as if the state's going to explode if you don't get $1.2 billion. Have you taken a look at the risks, though, of what happens if you don't start raising some revenue for roads?
Well, we've not ourselves looked at that, but I know that lots of credible sources inside the legislature, you know, Representative Olson took a hard look at this. The Transportation Funding Task Force, which was, you know, going back to the Granholm era of a partnership of business and labor and government government representatives, looked at this and just thought, you know, how much money do we really need? And, you know, there are widely varying answers, but all of them had the word billion after them. And 1.2, by some people's lights, isn't even enough going forward. Now, there's a practical matter here, which is that you can't actually close all the roads at once and fix them. We have to be able to use them at the same time. Anyone who has had remodeled their kitchen understands that, you know, you end up living a couple months cooking on a hot plate in your basement. Well, we would be in a situation like that with the roads if we tried to. So, there's the amount of money we need kind of on average going forward, and we really do need it. I mean, all these sources look at it that, you know, 1.2 is probably the minimum amount, honestly, we need. That's my judgment from reading other people's reports, okay. And I haven't you know, exactly done my own civil engineering study on that.
Now, there's one other thing I want to ask you about, and that is paying down the debt that we owe on old road funding projects, and there's a piece of that in this proposal. Do you think that's smart to use some of the initial money that we would get from this proposal to pay down old debt? Is that a good use of this money?
I think that I don't feel strongly about it one way or the other. I think it's a way of putting directly into the proposal that consideration I mentioned before, which is this idea that it's hard to spend it all at once. I think if they hadn't put that in there to pay off the debt, probably whatever funds weren't spent immediately would have either been saved up for future years or used to pay off debt. But this just hard codes it in there. You know, paying off that debt, it's essentially a decision to spend that money on future road building rather than present. I don't have a strong feeling about whether that was necessary or required. Furthermore, it only affects things for a couple of years anyway, so it's certainly not a make or break thing. I actually realized I didn't fully answer your question before. It's not like the state would explode if we put less than $1.2 billion. That's true. A partial solution is better than no solution. And they could make use of extra funds even if the legislature only came up with, you know, $600 million a year going forward. I would think that the danger there is that then in the minds of the voters, people think, well, didn't we solve that problem? We had this big discussion, mm-hmm. and we did something with it, and there's something. It's the hundreds of millions of dollars. That's a lot of money. That must have done it, right? And then we'll, you know, perhaps go 15 more years without fully addressing it.
And then the roads go to pot, and people will think, well, geez, didn't we solve it? And then the answer would be, well, no, actually, we didn't. And so then it just gets harder to
actually finish the entire solution.
It kicks the can down the road. That's right. Although, you know, sometimes kicking the can down the road is the best you can do. And you know, I'm not in this inside the legislature to know whether maybe you take half a loaf now and then revisit it later. That's just, you know, not my call.
Alex Rosane, he's with the Anderson Economic Group. Thanks for joining us on the podcast this week.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Joining me on the other end of the line is John Sousa, who is the head of the Draft Ben Carson for President Committee, and he's also the head of the committee to draft Ben Carson, which has been renamed the 2016 Committee, which is the super PAC to benefit Dr. Ben Carson. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So today is Monday, May 4, and this is the day that Ben Carson is announcing for president. And you can be associated with a person to help get this thing off the ground by starting the Draft Ben Carson campaign. Tell me how this started.
Some friends of mine and myself were sitting around talking about what a mess the country was in and what, if anything, we could do. And we kicked around some ideas, and then someone mentioned Dr. Carson's name. And we had all seen the National Prayer Breakfast speech, and a couple of us knew about him from reading some of his books and seeing the Gifted Hands movie. And one of us, kind of with a smirk on our face, said, well, why don't we try and draft the guy to run for president? And from a smirk that went to a serious conversation, which went to a test mailing of about 75,000 pieces around the country just to measure whether, you know, there might be any traction here. And test mailings almost always lose money, but this one actually made quite a bit of money. And the letters that accompanied the checks that came in were, oh, I hope Dr. Carson runs, great American, be a wonderful president. So we were very encouraged. We went back out with about 250,000 pieces of mail, and we got exactly the same kind of wonderful, enthusiastic response.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, for our listeners' benefit, tell us a little bit about you yourself. I understand you're the grandson of the famous American band leader, John Sousa. Tell us a little bit more about you and where you're from.
Well, I'm from Connecticut, originally born in New York, and have been kind of bi-coastal for most of my life. My great-grandfather was John Philip Sousa, the March King, which, of course, is a very proud heritage. He was an incredible American and patriot and ambassador for our country back at the turn of the century and around the Civil War. His most famous march, Stars and Stripes Forever, Ronald Reagan signed into law as our national march, and it's only the second piece of official music in the United States of America. On occasion, I go out and I narrate Sousa concerts. As a matter of fact, I'll be in Arizona this weekend doing one. And wonderful to be part of an incredible American.
Now, you said that you listened to Dr. Carson speak, and you were. What was it about him that got you excited about suggesting him for president?
There were a few things. It just seemed to me that watching his demeanor, very soft-spoken, very articulate, never raised his voice, never had a scowl on his face, and at the same time telling the President of the United States of America, who was sitting 2 feet from him, and his wife, who was sitting 3 feet from him, that his policies are wrong, that medical care, health care, should be between a patient and his doctor, and the government has no business getting in between a patient and his doctor. He told the President of the United States that political correctness was choking free speech in the United States, which of course it is. And he told the president that redistribution of wealth is simply the wrong way to try and help those in need. I thought to myself, if this man has that kind of courage to tell the president that he's wrong. And this is a president who doesn't like to be told that he's wrong. My goodness, maybe he has the courage to tell Putin to back his troops out. Maybe he has the courage to tell Iran, no, you're not going to make nuclear weapons, has the courage to support Israel, has the courage to bring America back to exceptionalism. That was really what got my attention.
Now, have you ever been able to meet Ben Carson?
I've met Dr. Carson once for a very brief time. I gave him a copy of the book I had written on John Philip Sousa, and he seemed very grateful and had a big smile on his face when I gave it to him. But that was well over a year ago. And I know he knows what we're doing out there. He was recently quoted in a New York Times magazine piece that he would be not nearly as far along if it weren't for the committee we set up.
So how much money have you guys been able to raise for this effort?
This has been incredible. We've raised over $16 million. Now, this is raising money for a person who's fundamentally unknown by most Americans, who said at the very beginning, I have no intention of running for president, who then went on to say, when I retired from medicine, I thought I would, just learn how to play the organ and learn how to play golf and so on and so forth. And in the beginning really gave us no or the American people any encouragement at all that he might run. But I think thanks to what the committee has been able to accomplish with over 500,000 petitions, and 140 or 150,000 individual donors, and 30,000 volunteers, active volunteers around the country. I think Dr. Carson has seen the light, and that he can win this.
You've got to be very personally excited to see Dr. Carson announced for president today in the city of Detroit.
I'm so excited. I can't stand it. I guess at one point or another, we all kind of ask ourselves, why are we here? And I guess I'm pushing 70, and I guess maybe this is the reason that God put me on the earth, was to start this thing and manage this thing and try and get Dr. Carson elected as president of the United States. And it's just such an honor for me to be a part of this movement.
Now, are you going to be in Detroit to watch this happen?
No, sadly not. I wish I could be, but there's just so much going on with the committee and so many things to do that I just can't take the time to be there. But what's really thrilling in looking at Dr. Carson's background and how he grew up and where he grew up and his mother, who I think when the Pope comes to the United States ought to give her sainthood. This is the most incredible woman who worked, three jobs cleaning houses so she could put food on the table for Dr. Carson and his brother, and who was illiterate and who was cleaning one gentleman's house one day and noticed that the television was all covered with books and the gentleman happened to walk into the room and she said, Mr. Jones, she says, how do you watch your television? It's all covered with books. He says, I don't watch television. I read books. And she went home that night and said, boys, we're going to start reading books. And every week I want you to read a book and give me a book report on what you've read. Now, keep in mind this woman was illiterate. She couldn't read the book reports that the boys were turning into her.
Oh, wow.
But that didn't stop her. She would look them over and say, very good job, Ben. Or she'd say, Ben, I think next week you can do a little better. And that prompted Dr. Carson to start reading books. And he went from last in his grade to first in his grade. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Wow, well, this is very exciting to see what you've been able to do here with Dr. Ben Carson, and I appreciate you joining us on our podcast today.
I'm just thrilled, and I hope everybody will take a good hard look at Dr. Carson for president.
All right, very good. John Sousa, he's the head of the 2016 committee, and he successfully helped draft Ben Carson to run for president. Have a good day, sir.
Thank you very much.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Alex Rozane for coming into MERS World Headquarters today and talking to us about Proposal 1. John Philip Sousa IV for taking some time and talking with us. John and Jacob, until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.